Well, boys, looks like you started the fun without me.
You're all sick. Every last one of you.
We're going to need a bigger gun.
What's the matter? You're scared of things that go boom, boom, boom.
Give me one goddamn reason why I shouldn't blow your goddamn brains all over that goddamn wall.
My name is Eric, and I'm here today with Ruby Rod. I had to. I couldn't stop myself. This is like the most quotable film of all time.
It is the most quotable film.
I'm not sure that anyone will agree with us.
I'm not Ruby Rod.
No, you are Michael Kester.
Sorry to disappoint everybody.
Oh, no one's disappointed.
Unless you're in, was it Switzerland or Sweden where I'm Michelle?
Oh, yeah. Man, we should read that email thing.
No, we shouldn't.
No?
No.
Okay.
Makes less goddamn sense than Tank Girl and Schindler's List,
yeah,
I'd say.
Yeah, it really does. We'll get to that at the year-end spectacular. But for now, this is double feature, and so we have two films for you.
Yeah, we do. We're going to cover The Man from Earth and The Fifth Element in a double-the-film double feature.
Wow, what a keen observer you are. That's not the theme, but both films do begin with a definite article from the English language, in this case, the. Man, we haven't done one of those in a long time, probably not since The Libertine and The Root of All Evil.
Yeah.
We need to get back to that thing we mentioned before where the titles sound like doo-wop bands, like Rafifi and the Triplets of Belleville.
Yeah.
Anyways, I've got my delicious Arizona raspberry iced tea here, so I'm pretty much ready to go.
All right.
So this episode is kind of our two different approaches to science fiction, two very different approaches to sci-fi.
Yeah.
Although I think it's common to see both of these ideas come together in films from the genre all the time, you know, in some combination. Originally, we wanted to do The Man from Earth, and we were thinking about doing it with Gattaca.
Yeah.
And it turns out that would have been a great double feature, but it also would have been really hard to watch because they're both so heady.
Yeah.
So we decided to go with one that's very talky, very kind of heady, a lot of ideas, very Star Trek, you know?
Right.
And one that's lots of blowing
very
stuff
Star
up
Wars.
And high fashion and, you know, good popcorn time.
So yeah, if we're going to do The Man from Earth first, and if you have not seen The Man from Earth, we're going to spoil it, and it's very spoilable.
Yeah, the whole
thing is like steak tartare.
Right.
It's already possibly spoiled just because you've heard about it.
Is that,
so you can use the chapter daily to jump to The Fifth Element.
You're getting good at this. You realize that if you don't do the chapter part that I ramble
on for
like 20 minutes.
You've forgotten multiple times and you've had to go back, and then we'll be like in the middle of the film and you'll be like, oh wait, I forgot to tell you that he always rides a blue horse.
Is that what I say?
Sometimes.
I know a lot of people listen even though they haven't, whatever. And we used to really try and get people to watch the films, but here's the deal. Like, if people are going to watch and spoil themselves, that's fine. So if you haven't seen The Man from Earth, we are going to try and give you an idea of what the fuck it's about, because it is a lot of talking. So why don't we start with The Man from Earth?
Let's start with The Man from Earth.
This is an incredible low budget. This reminds me of like the Hitchcock thing.
Yeah.
You know, like Hitchcock's done a lot of different kind of suspense, horror, thriller, whatever movies. The stuff of his that I really like is stuff like Dial M for Murder, Rope, stuff where you're in a room for the entire time.
Mm-hmm.
You're just, I don't know why I like that about movies, but I like just one stationary fucking phone booth. You know what I mean? Just like you're stuck in one place. You're not going anywhere. It's a rainy house. You're inside. You know what I mean? And one of the great things about that is that it costs basically nothing to do. You get a couple friends over. You hire
Tony Todd to rope in the horror community to watch your.
How did I guess that that's
Star
how you
Trek
found
film.
This film? It's Tony Todd, isn't
it's
it?
Tony Todd is in the film.
I'm getting to really know your films
because Candyman
very well
is in the film.
That I can look at them and just be like, oh, Tony Todd, that must be how he found this movie.
Yeah.
So when you have no budget, I mean, this movie was made for $200,000. That's like the Hollywood equivalent of free. It's no money at all. When you only have $200,000, you have to have a solid screenplay. Everything's going to be in the writing. You either have a great screenplay, as this movie does, or you have no movie at all.
Mm-hmm.
This was the last thing that Jerome Bixby ever wrote. And so, you know, we'll talk about all the writing and stuff. But that small budget also affects distribution, advertising, basically how many people even see your film. Although this movie isn't exactly huge, I think there's an interesting reason that it's as well known as it is. Back when we covered DOA, we talked about how file sharing was where that audience came from. You know, people downloaded DOA illegally, and that's why anybody even saw that movie. Although you saw The Man from Earth because of Tony Todd, I think most people found it through BitTorrent. You know, the film was reviewed on a file sharing website. They were talking about, so the kind of place they usually talk about quality of the rip, and people obviously go there to get links to free movies and whatever. But Eric Wilkinson, the producer, found the review and thanked them for, you know, talking about his film, and it became this big thing. he was essentially endorsing piracy. You know, as long as people could see his movie, he didn't really care how. So that story snowballed. People got word of it, started downloading the movie, and it went from the 11,000th most popular film on IMDb to number 5. I mean, in less than a week, it was the most downloaded movie online. So I don't know. We talked a lot about that stuff when we did the episode on Steal This Film. So I don't want to go into that too much here. But yeah. Instead, I guess I'm just dying to jump into the story.
The basic general setup for the beginning of the film, before all the talking really commences, is that there's a college professor of... They don't really let you in on what he teaches, but he's leaving. He's going away.
Right.
He's been there for 10 years. He's packing up and moving, and there's kind of a... impromptu goodbye gathering of some mm-hmm. other of the college professors to first off figure out why he's leaving,
right,
and second off just drink some...
You forgot a crucial detail. His friends are college professors and a literal Christian.
And a Christian literalist.
Which is apparently her qualification for being mm-hmm. there, which is a little weird. So the setup for this is, rather than taking a sci-fi film, which, you know, very often sci-fi films get imagined as these, like, big budget...
Laser beams.
Sort of. Yeah, it's laser beams. No, you're absolutely right. That's exactly what it is. It's a CGI fest. You want to see spaceships docking and crazy shit flying around and monsters and whatever. This takes a sci-fi concept, definitely a sci-fi concept, and it just shows off the writing.
Yeah.
It's weird. Sci-fi fans will tell you that the, you know, one of the leading characteristics of science fiction is that the writing is so good,
yeah.
You know? People who don't like sci-fi will tell you they don't like sci-fi because the writing is campy and corny and mm-hmm. beyond their suspension disbelief.
Well, it's because there's, for most sci-fi, we're talking about sci-fi column B, which uh-huh. we'll get into later with The Fifth Element. But it's because a lot of the dialogue is like, blah, 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 my name is Lilu and I'm going to use a ZF-1 to fire a Fifth Element.
Right. Like, is that what happens in that film?
Something like that. Multipass.
And you think that's why people have a problem latching on to science fiction?
Well, yeah. I mean, Total Recall is a really good example. People right. just kind of use their own random terminology.
Sure, sure.
You just kind of have to use context clues.
Here you have a large level of suspension of disbelief, but it's beyond the terminology.
Right.
It's not about terminology. And I think this just shows off good writing. You know, it's about accepting a premise and then seeing where you can go with that. The long-standing idea of jumping the shark, that is to use the, what is that, a Happy Days reference,
yeah.
right?
Jumping the shark is when you've pushed your audience beyond their realm of suspension of disbelief.
Sure, right.
What happens in Happy Days, I mean, it's a great example to just sure. say what happens. Fonzie is, like, water skiing, and everybody, and I think he still has his leather jacket on, I don't
right.
know. But, like, the audience I can already imagine was like, this is kind of weird.
Right.
He literally comes upon a shark, and he has to jump over it for his own well-being. And
right.
I mean,
it's something you have to consider when you make, especially science fiction, because you always want to push the boundaries, but you don't want to jump the proverbial shark. And part of that is seen as cashing in. People are just like, what's the most ridiculous shit, you know, we can put in here to make people go, oh, what the fuck, he jumped over, you know, that's just too much.
Yeah.
It's too much. We didn't want that. So sci-fi always has to kind of straddle that line. I think the generally accepted premise is that you have one given when you do a sci-fi film. There's one thing you can tell us about this world that we have to accept, even if it's the world itself.
Right.
Here, our one thing is that this dude's a caveman.
Yeah.
That's essentially what's
going
on. John
Oldman, 14,000 years old.
Right. If you expect us to take something that doesn't fall within that premise or some huge new rule halfway through the, you know, through the film, mm-hmm. you see sci-fi fail so often because halfway through the film, they're like, oh, here was a rule you just didn't know about.
Right.
And it's like a big thing. And that's kind of jumping the shark there. That's something that famously the Lost writers have always struggled with.
Right.
Because they think that they need to jump the shark every episode. You know, that's,
yeah.
I've heard Damon talk about that before, one of the writers on Lost, that he feels like you're not making good TV if you're not at least,
yeah.
you know, on the verge of jumping the shark over and over. So here our premise is that this is a prehistoric man.
Yeah.
And we try to build upon a story and see if we can even kind of go some new directions, if we can throw in some new twists, but just based on that one solid premise.
Well, and the thing is, the suspension of disbelief, by the end, This is one of those things where it's just the suspension of disbelief is just, it crescendos. Because the very beginning, it's even pitched as like, oh yeah, I'm just, it's a sci-fi story.
Right. Well, I think that's one of the things that makes selling the suspension of disbelief fantastic.
Yeah.
You know, that's something I'm really curious about in film is how do you, there's a couple ways. When we talk about horror stuff, usually it's just throw people into it.
Yeah, that's the best way. In horror, it's the complete opposite. In horror, you need to maybe not show the most graphic, like upsetting, horrific thing, but you need to, like, one of your top three has got to happen before the fucking credits.
Sure. Well, and if you're going to jump the shark, if you do it in the opening scene, then people are set up for, you know what I mean?
You need to eat the shark in the first scene.
Right. You basically start, if you're going to have, like, mutants, you know, raping a poor survival girl, you need to do it, like, right in the first scene, and then people know what kind of film this is.
Yeah, people that way, know that it's not The Last Mimsy.
Right. Halfway through, they don't go, oh, this has mutant rape? I didn't know what I was in store for. You know what you're in store for, and you either accept it or you don't. You go, okay, there's a monster man driving a truck, or there just isn't. You know, I have cannibals or I don't have cannibals, and you can make your decision at that point if you want to watch the film.
You've watched a lot of horror, my friend.
What you don't want to do is go halfway through the film and go, oh, there's cannibals. That's probably not a good idea. I don't know that I want to watch that type of film, because you've already been watching for an hour. So here we start with this great device for suspension of disbelief, which is different from the horror method of just throwing your audience in, which is an okay method, but the method here is that we're pitching this to a highly skeptical audience of professors.
Right. Well, and they're all well-educated in different areas, so it's pitched in a way, and this is how it's a great idea to get the audience, like, to kind of understand the implications, because he goes, okay, so in a scenario where a Cro-Magnon were alive today, how would that have played out? And he asks all these people who are experts in the areas, and they all kind of lend their expertise. They're like, assuming normal intelligence, he would probably be indistinguishable, and the other guy, you know, says, yeah, it's pretty much the same. And the biologist says, well, as long as he had, like, perfect regeneration of tissue and no waste, then he would physically wouldn't
kind of sets up your premise. Yeah. Even if you know you're playing a little loose with the ideas, you're playing in theory. And I think that's the best realm for science fiction to tackle is when you kind of play in theoretical science, you know, or futuristic science, you know, this stuff that's well beyond our technology today, but still foreseeable, still kind of rooted in a scientific element.
Yeah.
What's great about bouncing these ideas off these people is, you know, we kind of have to have this conversation about jumping the shark and about suspension of disbelief, because that's sort of what's going on in the film.
Yeah.
You know, he's pitching this idea to this group of people, and it's a real-time cinematic examination of the idea of suspension of disbelief. Some people are like, whoa, that's too much for me. Some people are like, you know, the biologist guy's like, all right, I'll go with it. I'll play your game.
Having a good time.
Yeah, and he's really having a good time even through the end.
Yeah.
Even at the point in the end where everybody's kind of like, oh, that was an awful day. See ya. Awkward, you know. He's still like, well, I guess we kind of played that game and I lost and there you go. You know?
So the film kind of unfolds and the lead, John, essentially says, you know, he's a Cro-Magnon, and they kind of examine all the implications of that, and people keep trying to trump him and confuse him and trick him. And every time the thing that keeps essentially coming up for the first third of the film, at least after he's made the announcement, I guess, is that he says
Can we call that the part with furniture?
Yeah.
That'll be the...
Okay,
so, you know what else is kind of funny on that note really quick? So you have a low-budget film, and when you're making a low-budget film, you want to utilize everything, you know, available to you to give your film the appearance of a higher budget. So they obviously have the availability of a house full of furniture, but for whatever, like, really unnecessary plot element in it, they decide that a furniture crew is going to come in at the end of the first act and remove all their furniture, thusly making it almost makes you think, did they have the furniture out on loan for one day to shoot? It's just an interesting idea to mix up the scenery when you only have one setting in your film. You know, just moving the furniture kind of helps things from being too static. Sorry, what were you saying though?
So he keeps saying things and people kind of cross-check him. They're like, how did you know? How did you know that this was going on? How did you know it was 2,000 years? How did you know you were Cro-Magnon? And every time the answer is, I didn't know then.
Right.
I had to wait until science knew, and that's when I knew.
Well, because he has this great idea about he was only in one
place.
One place. And you know, the other thing that's wonderful about that is that he's not a super genius.
Right.
You know, this kind of examines the vampire myth really well. You know, you're looking at somebody who can exist forever. Why aren't they, you know, a trillionaire, and why don't they have world-class skill in all fields? And To some extent, I mean, I think you could play different financial games sure. to have $1 trillion or whatever. But the question well, here betting. Is why isn't, you know, the first question becomes, why isn't he stupid like a caveman?
Right.
And the second question is, why isn't he the smartest man yeah. alive?
Why doesn't he have a really big head and like levitate everywhere?
Well, and he, is that what you get from being super smart?
Sci-fi.
Well, and he gives an excuse for why he's not the smartest man alive.
His excuse is, he just says like, I can only be as intelligent as everyone around me is.
Sure, sure.
He has 7 or 8 degrees that he says he has.
Yeah, 10,
but,
I think.
Yeah, 10, okay, but... You know, he got his biology degree back in the 1800s, sure, so, right. you know, that's about as valid as a
right.
napkin.
It reminds me of programming. I got a fucking bullshit programming degree a couple years ago, and programming has such a half-life because they just invent new technologies yeah. all the time. So if you're not actively practicing in the field, yeah. as my degree didn't really do anything right. for me, within like 6 months, you don't know anything anymore.
Yeah, and
your
I mean,
degree might as well
biology
be worthless.
Is the same thing from right. the 1800s sure, sure. to now. Like,
well, yeah, that's... Yeah, it has maybe less of a half-life than programming does, but you see what I mean. It's yeah. like, what good does that, you know,
exactly. do? So he essentially says, he's like, I can only, you know, I can't learn everything.
Sure.
I can only learn as much as one person can learn at a time.
So if you're not going to become super rich and you're not going to become super smart, right, because you only have, you know, the world's knowledge at the time, what is being alive that long good for? I mean, what would you do as a person? What would make you outstandingly different from all of the people of the present time?
Not too
I mean,
much.
Do you become super skilled in things? Is
well,
that...
well, you know, you can't really become any more skilled than anybody because he might be, let's say he's probably more adept at, say, fashioning a spear, maybe building a fire, right. that kind of thing.
Okay.
But who fucking cares?
Sure.
You know, come the Bronze Age, like, oh yeah, I'm really good. I'm a great spear maker. They're like, sure. okay, well... make us a sword. And he's like, right. I don't know how to make a sword.
Well, you know, when I think back even to, okay, so let's go like Interview with the Vampire kind of thing, right? Lestat plays piano because he's fucking existed for whatever. Uh-huh. And then in Queen of the Damned, he becomes a new metal rock star. The point is that, you know, the idea with sort of Anne Rice's vampires is that over time they could learn a specific trait and get really good at it. But here it kind of makes you question, even the greatest piano players, they kind of learn by looking at what is, you know, what has been achieved at piano,
right.
you know, at that sort of art form throughout time.
Well, the greatest piano players aren't the inventors of the piano.
Right.
You know
right.
what I mean?
Exactly.
Like, that's really, yeah. that's, you can't just because you were around long, like, the man that invented the piano
sure.
probably wasn't as good as, like, the top 500 pianists
right.
since him.
Right, so if you look at the literal skill of that, you know, it's an art form, so it's a little bit different yeah. than, like, I don't know, woodwork or some kind of, like, some real, like,
well,
blue-collar,
I mean,
handsy
then let's
kind
go,
of skill.
Let's switch from piano to, like, let's say woodwork or carpentry.
Right.
You know, the first person to ever go, I can take this thin, sharp piece of metal and use it to fasten these pieces of wood together, mm-hmm. he ain't as good as, like, the top... dude today. Not
yeah, and
close.
I guess that craft evolves too, right?
Yeah.
So even, you know, when you look at something like music as a craft, today's music isn't ultra complicated.
Right.
The stuff that becomes hits and even the stuff that is like wicked fucking good, it's sort of an amalgam of earlier music that came before. You know, look at eye rolling, I know, but like look at the Beatles, right? Everybody's influenced by the Beatles. And the Beatles were influenced by somebody before that and somebody before that. So it's just these constant ideas that are built upon throughout culture. It's the same thing with, you know, to go back to piano.
Right.
You know, you do so much with piano, but you only have the ideas that are in your head.
Yeah.
No matter how long you live,
right.
you have to keep coming up with those ideas. So you see the ideas of those around you, but it's not till, you know, the reason we have these advances in civilization and in art is because there's fucking 7 billion yeah. of us. You know, so it only takes one guy
yeah.
to make a huge breakthrough, and then we can kind of piggyback off
yeah.
him. So that even makes sense, I think.
Yeah.
I know this has been a really drawn out examination of why.
Well, this film begets examination.
Yeah,
like,
it absolutely
that's what
does.
It, that's what it asks
sure.
you to do.
Yeah.
A film that is a conversation can do nothing but warrant a larger conversation.
Well, I think the other thing this does via conversation is it's a great example of skeptical analysis, especially in film. I mean, film never really gets skeptical analysis right. Even when they do, they kind of have to backhand you with some, like, talk about Jesus or how science doesn't know everything. You
yeah.
fall into some cliche.
Sure.
And even the best science fiction, you know, Star Trek has its moments even. I know it's the holy grail of skeptical, and I know people are cringing when I just invoke it. But even it has its moments where it doesn't quite get the science or the thought patterns
yeah.
right. But here I'm really amazed how we can have a two-hour conversation about this without falling really into every cliche in the book.
Right.
You know, by all means, this film, if you gave me this premise, I'd be like, this is going to be a bunch of cliches.
Yeah.
It's going to be about, because I mean, it gets religious too. Yeah. And that's when I go, okay, here's cliche territory. Well,
that's the part that I was talking about with the suspension of disbelief. If they drop that bomb right away.
Sure.
Like if he did, instead of going, because the film could have taken that option.
Sure.
It could have gone backwards instead of forwards. It could have gone instead of, what if I were a Cro-Magnon? People right. kind of examine. What if it could have gone the other way? I was Jesus.
Well, that's
and then,
sort of, yeah.
And then they're like, "How could you be Jesus?" And then it goes backwards. He's like, "Well, I was born way before."
It seems like then you're doing it in the wrong order.
Right.
Then you're telling people this tale and kind of giving your excuses for how that.
You know, right. Exactly.
How that came about. He's almost hesitant to, he doesn't want the plot to go there, yeah. right? He doesn't want to talk about being Jesus. He's like, no, that's jumping the shark, guys. Let's not even invoke that. And they're like, no, come on. We've been doing this for two hours.
And that's what the audience is doing watching the film, too. They're like, okay, come on.
Right.
Come on, you can't like hold out the Bible
thing. But after an
hour,
there's some people in the audience within the film that are going, you know what? I've accepted your given premise. We've taken that pretty far. I'm curious what this other thing is.
And then there's other people who are like, that's sacrilege.
Right, that's blasphemy.
And try to walk out of the
theater. Well, that's another great way is where normally a guy telling me halfway through the film that he's Christ would make me kind of roll my eyes. But the person here who's rolling their eyes is
someone you roll your eyes at
is the Christian literalist. Yeah. So you're kind of going, okay, well, I don't want to be that person.
Yeah.
So I guess I'll buy this premise and run with it. But the entire thing goes through this great skeptical analysis where people pose questions to him and they stick to, there's two kinds of working of skepticism. There's two kinds of skepticism. There's the sort of working pragmatic skepticism. And then there's the literal skepticism. It's the same way with atheism, mm-hmm. not to tie those too closely, but we talked about this back with the, I think it was the Expelled show, where I can sit here and I can go, okay, there's no God. I know that. That's a fact. And that's pragmatic for me. That's very practical. I can go, okay, I know that. That's how I live my life.
Yeah.
But then there's the more literal version where I don't really know there's no God. I'm just pretty fucking sure there's no God.
Even that particular conversation comes up when he mentions how he thinks he might have met somebody else.
Right.
Maybe also like him and had lived forever. And it just kind of turns into this thing where he's like, well, I couldn't be sure that he wasn't just pulling my leg. Right. And, you know,
and that also serves to put him in their shoes to say, why you guys are
he's
so
like,
skeptical.
He says,
about
like, I wanted to believe him, but, like, just as much as I wanted to believe him, I didn't want to put that kind of faith in somebody that could. Because the film itself shows that it's an easy thing to lie about. Honestly, all you have to do is if you present it in the right situation to the right group of people and you have quick enough answers,
mm-hmm.
people are going to at least lean to not throwing it completely out because as Tony Todd says, I think 40 times and the biologist says a few times as well, anything's possible.
Right.
And I think that's kind of the coda to the whole film.
Sure. Well, that's looking at, again, at that question of practical versus literal. Anything is literally possible, but not practically possible. You know, quantum physics is something that happens, and it's not practically something you would think about.
It's something that theoretically happens.
Well, yeah, okay. But you see what I mean? It's something that we're looking at on a literal level, but that doesn't mean we can extrapolate that to the point that, you know, all of our laws of physics are
thrown out the
window.
Well, yeah, that's the thing.
Had you said that's impossible,
right.
under all sets and conditions, under all rules of physics, before we started learning and theorizing about quantum mechanics, we would have said practically impossible.
Right. Well, that's what happens. That's what quantum mechanics and let's parallel quantum mechanics in this film for a moment if this isn't too heady already.
No, that's fine.
So quantum mechanics kind of worked from this scenario where people go, this doesn't make any goddamn sense.
Sure.
How do we get, instead of going, how do we move beyond point A, they go, this is what we want.
Uh-huh.
How do we make this get back to here?
Sure.
And that, as far as I'm concerned, is probably the way the film went.
Right.
The film was like, I kind of want to do this film where this guy kind of inspired the teachings of Christ, but like rejects the Bible in and of itself. Sure. How do we get from point Z to point like C.
Back to point C. Well, and they also invoke quantum mechanics in here.
Yeah.
And usually, as soon as a film starts doing that, they do it as a way of saying science doesn't know everything.
Right.
Or look how weird. Because they don't. No one fucking understands quantum mechanics.
It's because quantum mechanics is designed to be against the laws of physics. That's why it was developed. It was developed as a counter a counter theory to normal physics.
On a really micro level.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, compatible. But, right. Sorry, we do not need to launch into quantum physics. But my point was that it's sort of a cliche in film to invoke it. And I was really happy to hear, maybe for the first time ever, someone invoking quantum physics in film where little skeptical me didn't explode and right. go, what the fuck? Yeah. And, you know, again, eye rolling to be induced. So to return once more to our examination of practical versus literal skepticism, we have different people who approach things practically or literally in relation to their reaction to right. what he's telling them. A couple people are, you know, first of all, they're going, all right, you're done with this. Yeah. I can't listen to this anymore.
I think it's important for us to bring in the psychologist because we haven't mentioned him.
Sure.
And he kind of gets brought in.
Our returning role from Hatchet. Yeah. I love this guy. Really
he kind of gets brought in kind of because of the, I wish I could remember their names. Their names like so fall on my my deaf ears.
There is a lot to soak in.
But the one professor with the motorcycle,
right?
He kind of calls the psychologist over and he's like, think John's going crazy.
And they make a joke about Freud right away. So, you know, whatever psychobabble he's going to spew out, they've kind of already rolled their eyes.
And they kind of bring him in to kind of examine the sanity of the situation. But they also use him later to see, he comes in and he becomes this for, you know, lack of a better word, he becomes this voice of reason to this group of people who maybe have gone off the deep end a little bit in their interests.
Yeah.
And he kind of goes, hey, guys, dude's fucking crazy. Like, like even though your science can prove that it happens, this ain't real. This guy's nuts.
Well, and the science thing
comes back to prove the point, at least for the audience.
Well, the science thing is interesting because that's the more, you know, their appeal to science is where it gets a little more literal, where they go, okay, we need to step back for a second and do some Carl Sagan here. We cannot... You know, we cannot disprove this any more than we can prove it.
Right.
All we can do is look at the evidence. And that's where this great bridge comes in between literal skepticism and practical skepticism. Because everybody's been practically skeptical until they've gotten to a boiling point where they need the answers. And this guy's going, all right, well, literally, there's no way that, you know, we can be, all we can do is be informed, right? We can never know either way. So this changes our practical approach. We should, instead of needing an answer as human beings, just naturally, you know, that's just part of our chemistry. We need to know things. Why don't we just accept that we're not going to know, and that will open us up for more examination? And I think that kind of bridge there is maybe one of my favorite writing points of this entire thing.
I agree.
It should also be said that, I mean, the cast in this is pretty fantastic, especially for a totally unknown cast that I really
recognize. Aside from Tony Todd and Hatchet.
Right. And Hatchet. You don't even know the guy's name, do you?
Paul from Addio.
Is that it?
That's his character's name in Hatchet.
Oh, that's fantastic. You know, and every time new characters are kind of added or removed... I really enjoy seeing them, and I'm always like, oh, I like this group. Don't bring in the Freud guy. And then I see it's the dude from Hatch, and I'm like, yeah, he's coming back. So that's really fun too. I just thought this movie was a great examination of skepticism, something that sci-fi does really well. Maybe something that people should look at for doing more of these like independent, just high concept kind of ideas. I think it's great. I think we move from here to the polar opposite of that, right?
Yeah, we'll take another element of science fiction here.
Aziz Light. It is so quotable. I can't.
It's probably one of the most quotable films ever made.
So we're talking about the French film, The Fifth Element. Mm-hmm. A lot of people don't know it's a French film.
Yeah,
well, I really, this played at Facets a couple months back. It was one of the only Facets thing that I've missed out on because I just totally spaced that night. But they described it as, Facets is a theater in Chicago we talk about every once in a while. They do kind of cult movies and
popular.
Generally unknown movies, popular stuff.
Unpopular popular films.
Right. Well, stuff that was popular 15 years ago. Yeah. And they kind of examine it and they do a little Q&A before and after.
Films with Gary Oldman.
Right. It's a good, if you like this show, you'd be into it. But they described it as a fun, fashionable sci-fi romp, I think.
There you go.
Or something about high fashion. I kind of...
You can't disagree.
I kind of turned my head at that, and I was just sort of like, really? Fashion is the angle you're going? But there's so much to... I'm going to say this here and now, because I think this will become obvious in our conversation. I believe this is the single greatest popcorn sci-fi film that exists.
That's probably
in existence.
It's probably the case.
Sci-fi does a lot of things, as we just talked about with The Man from Earth. But if you're going to talk about a movie that doesn't attempt to probe any situations too hard, it's about characters. It's about liking the characters, not really getting to know them deeply.
And the end of the earth.
Well, yeah, that too. It's about kind of mythology, and it's about fun at the end of the day. It's about building a great, fun world to be in. And I think this movie just gets it right all over absolutely. The place.
Well, I mean, you start with like a ridiculously strong cast. You start with, you got Mia Jovovich in arguably the defining role of her career.
Yeah, you know, it's one of her, so there's like a controversy about how old she was. Doesn't matter, we're not going to get into the tabloid thing here. But she was really fucking young when she played this. It's one of her first roles. And she is full of fucking life, quirky and brilliant and just beautiful. She's gorgeous in this role.
And you have Bruce Willis, who's fresh off the John McClane boat.
Yeah, and has hair.
Still wearing hair.
I'm not going to lie. I just love Bruce Willis with hair, something about that. And he's playing, you know, New York cab driver.
Right.
I mean, like, I mentioned this to you, but this film should fail on paper.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, this should be like the stupidest fucking thing you ever. Oh, yeah, we're just going to get this down and dirty Jersey cab driver, and like, we're going to get this fucking loudmouth radio jive talking DJ. And I don't know, let's just get some fashion model in here to be the chill. Like, it should fail.
And you also, you have Ian Holm, who plays Cornelius, the priest.
Sure.
And Gary Oldman is Zorg, the arms dealer with the see-through hat.
First Gary Oldman role I ever saw. Not enough good can be said about Gary Oldman.
My favorite role, probably. I'm slowly compiling a list. I'll have it on. I'm gonna announce it on the show when I finally put it together. But I'm compiling a list of my top 10 film characters of all time.
Oh, really?
And I definitely
year end special.
I think we can do it. Then.
All right, great.
I definitely. I think you can expect to see Ruby Rod.
Yeah.
Chris Tucker is Ruby Rod definitely in the top 10.
He's fantastic. I mean, I don't know what more you could say about this guy. He's like, the thing that's crazy about it is it's just Chris Tucker. It's Chris Tucker doing like gay Dennis Rodman.
Yeah, that's what it is. I mean,
he's more flamboyant and more energetic. And
I hate using this phrase, but it's Chris Tucker unhinged.
Yeah.
That's what it is. Because he's
they not, let the leash off.
He's not filling. Uncaged. He's not filling a role.
Right.
He's just trying to. They're just like, you need to just be as over the top as possible. Here are your lines,
which is perfect because what better role than like a morning fucking zoo house DJ?
Yeah.
The most bullshit like caricature of all popular culture is the morning zoo house DJ, and Chris Tucker plays him. But just better than I've ever seen.
Absolutely.
It's so much fun to be around this guy. You always remember The Fifth Element. This is just a great experiment. Which, by the way, if you haven't seen the fucking Fifth Element, what are you doing?
Yeah.
You're missing out on the most fun you'll ever have in a movie. Like, go see this thing. You always remember The Fifth Element as being, you know, it's got Milo and it's got Corbin Dallas and it's got Ruby Rod. You remember Chris Tucker as one of the characters. He shows up in like the last 30 minutes.
Halfway through the film.
Yeah, I would say over half. And, I mean, well, they're already well into the plot.
Yeah, that's true.
You don't see him till you get on the spaceship.
I think what happens is they kind of chuck him in. I think the writers at some point were going like, okay, this is getting heavy. We need one of them good old comic reliefers.
Right, is that it?
I'm just usually talking out my ass.
No, you don't know what you're talking about. I think the movie has a lot more vision than that.
Yeah,
you know
I agree.
I mean, this thing is iconic as fuck all. You have these shots that are just centered and gorgeous and big and expansive, and you have a return to models, you know? There is CG in this, but a lot of it comes from model work, which we announced the death of models back. You mentioned Total Recall, which was one of the last big budget model films. Everything kind of started using computer-generated graphics after that. And this return to models and just the set design and anything that anyone had to physically carve, paint, and or otherwise create looks gorgeous. This place he lives in, the cab he drives, the spaceship they go to, I cannot get enough of these sets. I mean, I can see why Facets liked the fashionable element of it. You know, one of the most interesting things to look at in sci-fi is always what do they do with their world? Some sci-fi films ride solely on, you know, the world that the creators have built.
Right.
Here you have just the home he lives in. That's always interesting to me is the sci-fi home. You know, how has the home kind of evolved?
It's kind of like a hybrid between like a hotel room
and a prison cell.
Studio apartment and a college dorm.
Yeah, it kind of is. You have these beds that fold in and they get like saran wrapped and rolled back up. The refrigerator thing.
The refrigerator is the shower.
Yeah, right. Is the shower.
Pneumatic tubes. There's still pneumatic tubes.
I guess one of his walls like folds up to the outside because there's that point where he's doing a scene from Blade Runner and mm-hmm. like eating the Chinese food or whatever. Yeah. But then you also have little stuff like the weaponry or even the cigarettes, you know, they're all filter.
Yeah.
Which I think is kind of self-explanatory there. But, you know, his alarm clock. I love the score in this too.
Yeah.
You have something that starts out with, I used to actually, this is just great for fans of The Fifth Element. Set your iPod alarm. You can make a little clip on iTunes using the score. Set it to the thing that Corbin Dallas wakes up at and just like set it so your fucking sound system just rocks out every morning with the Corbin Dallas wake up alarm. It's awesome. But we start with that weird thing where it's like a mix of orchestral score,
yeah.
but also this industrial pipe
banging
thing.
On percussion.
Yeah, is that what it is?
Yeah.
And then sometimes we have, you know, just to go right through that, this is all just, let's say in 10 minutes of the film, we go from orchestral meets industrial pipe percussion to a like light sort of piano falling in love medley there. Right. We go from that soft lounge thing to a bigger piano section. Then we go to like this tango kind of feel.
Oh, yeah. When they're in the gypsy.
Yeah, what is that? I don't even know what that is. And then there's
getaway music for you.
Well, and then there's some accordion score going on. Because it's a French film, you have to have accordion mm-hmm. score, which kind of comes from that tango. But I think it sort of does something a little bit different. And then the more mellow stuff in between scenes is kind of these pads and this, I wouldn't call it new age because I hate to, anytime yeah. you call music new age, it's just an insult. But you know what I mean? It's very pad based. And then there's even a reggae song, like
right.
when they're taking off on mm-hmm. the space cruise.
It's a sexy takeoff scene.
And it's not just, we're not just doing Pee Wee's Big Adventure. How many different things right. can we throw in here? They really all lend themselves. So, I don't know about the reggae song, but all the other stuff lends itself really well. Well, you look at that reggae piece and it's...
It goes really well with the furry gooey guys that fall off the bottom.
Well, yeah,
of the
and then you have like Ruby Rod going down on that chick. And I don't know, I never associated reggae with having sex, but apparently Ruby Rod does.
In France, man.
Can we just dismiss all
in
this
France,
stuff we don't
in
understand?
In France, women dreadlock their bush.
That's a great double feature kind of idea, is that if you don't understand something in a French film, you just dismiss it as being French and then you move on.
Rastagina.
The juxtaposition of what's going on under the aircraft, burning off the things, their takeoff, him going down on the chick, all that stuff comes together really, really well. I think one of the things that this does beyond, you know, beyond score, beyond blending big beat with accordion, beyond set decoration and beyond the cast, is that occasionally it will make this odd decision it's not an odd decision, it's a highly effective one, to juxtapose different footage together with other things that
are going on. So there's a full conversation going on between like three different parties?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. yeah. And one kind of sets up the joke to yeah. the previous scene.
Well, it's how you show that everybody's on the same page.
Sure.
Right. It's a really,
it makes it flow.
It's a really effective way of dispelling people being like, well, how did they know that Corbin got off the ship?
Even if it doesn't literally make sense, the fact that it's kind of juxtaposed as a joke just makes you feel like, okay, I guess they're talking about something else.
Right.
But it also implies that, like we talked about, if you've seen Dark City, I won't spoil the scene, but we talk about the great camera work at the end of that, implying that someone knows something that literally
right.
on the, you know, in the world that day, they wouldn't know.
Right.
But the camera work kind of tells you they know that. We do the same thing here, but we do it almost for jokes.
Mm-hmm.
So people just roll right along with it. That editing is just one of the components, you know, maybe one of the more subtle components, although I don't know if anything about this movie is fucking subtle, that has helped it remain so iconic over the years. It's so hard to talk about this movie without it just being a giant list of quotes that I enjoy.
Yeah.
And, you know, well, hey, isn't this scene cool? And I try and refrain from that because why does anyone give a shit about a list of scenes I think are cool? But I mean, stuff like the cab, you know what I mean? Just being inside
yeah,
the cab and
right.
like the cab's all after the big chase and it's like flipped and then he's got to like go through the top of it and just designing the interior of that. Or stuff like when Zorg is showing the ZF-1. I mean, scenes like that, you have to see them. There's nothing that can really be said about that. It's a badass gun. It's got like six things in one. It's a funny scene. Gary Oldman is amazing. I mean, this is something that you just have to fucking see it,
yeah,
and it's
do.
Brilliant. It turns out that we have a website, it's doublefeatureshow.com, and an email address where you can send us feedback like, what, The Fifth Element, a good film? Blasphemy. So send us an email. It's doublefeatureshow@gmail.com. We haven't mentioned this in a while, I don't think, but there's a MySpace and a Facebook.
I forgot MySpace existed.
Yeah, right. So you can go on there. You can like become our friend and chat us up and do whatever there. You, if you want to talk, you should just email us because we just email all the time. We also have an iTunes account that you know about. You know about this. Rebecca Watson mentioned this. Mm-hmm. If you didn't go on iTunes and leave us feedback, Rebecca Watson doesn't want to be your friend anymore. Mm-hmm. So you should listen to what she says and leave feedback. What are we doing next time on the show?
If you want some more, we're going to do Spawn and Requiem for a Dream.
Yeah, actually, you're jumping ahead a week. That's not... Don't look at that paper. That's wrong. We are going to do Spawn and Requiem eventually. Week after next, we're going to do that. Next week, we're doing Killapalooza 8. We're doing the Leprechaun films, which, by the way, we are running dry on the Killapaloozas. We don't often solicit listener requests. But if you know a good horror series or like slasher franchise that has more than, let's say, at least five films, doublefeatureshow@gmail.com should let us know what we should be doing in Killapaloozas in the future. We get a couple picked out, but I mean, we're doing Leprechaun, so obviously we're towards the end.
Watch more fucking film.
Bye.